This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 31st of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show with me, Tom Morris. Today we'll be jetting down to the French Riviera, where the world's property developers meet for their annual jamboree. But what place does design have there?
When there's less properties out there, it becomes a little bit more competitive. And by being more competitive, I think design, focused design, brings a little bit more of added value.
From the shores of the Mediterranean to Singapore, where we meet British star designer Thomas Heatherwick.
Often you feel that a building has to be 100 years old before it will get any soulfulness. Our building's got bubbles in the concrete and stones poking through, but it's got a heart.
And then we get back to the water with a look at the maritime charms of naval uniforms and fishermen's outfits as a new book charts nautical influences on fashion.
There's this kind of very interesting long lineage of the sailor being quite sexualized and being this very physical, manly icon that then has been reappropriated by designers like Gautier.
All that and much more besides on Section D, Monocle's dedicated design show here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, earlier this month, Monocle's associate editor Matt Alagaya hopped over to Cannes in the south of France for one of the world's leading property fairs, MIPIM. Taking place every March, the fair is a magnet for city leaders, developers and, of course, architecture practices. With 93 countries represented and over 4,500 investors among the total 22,000 delegates, MIPIM 2015 was proof that the global property market is emerging from its long rocky patch. But how is this affecting architects? Matt spoke to several practices while he was there to gauge the mood.
I'm currently standing on the Promenade de la Croisette, the famous coast-hugging strip of restaurants and hotels in Cannes on France's Côte d'Azur. It's the first day of MIPIM, the city's annual mid-March property fair, and all around me, civic leaders, businessmen, developers and architects are streaming in through the doors of the Palais des Festivals exhibition centre. This is where, over the next 3 days, deals will be forged and contracts signed that will shape our cityscapes for years to come. And I'm here to talk to some of the architects who have come here to trumpet their reputations and attract clients.
It's more about being seen and being with the right people than actually doing business here.
Sean Weston is project director at the medium-sized London-based practice A Studio.
Very rarely do we walk away from MIPIM with a project in our back pocket. It's about telling our story, telling what we've done in the previous year and what we're planning on doing in the year going forward. So for us as a practice, it's an important part of our calendar.
Stephen Hodder is the president of the Royal Institute of British Architects and a practicing architect based in Manchester. His organisation is here promoting 19 chartered practices from the UK. He explains what it means for them to attend MIPIM.
Essentially, we're facilitators, so they are looking to promote themselves internationally. But of course, the thing about MIPIM, of course, is this incredible concentration of not just developers and investors outside of the UK, but of course, they're here. It's quite ironic, isn't it, that we all come to the south of France. So there are many, many UK investors here. So it's a great networking event and an opportunity for those practices to promote themselves.
The global property market is bouncing back from a long period of uncertainty. But while this makes life difficult for developers and architects alike, there are a few positive side effects for those who are getting projects off the ground. Andrew Bromberg is International Design Director at IDIS, a large Hong Kong-based architecture practice.
I think people are starting to be a little bit more design-focused, which is really good. I think they're starting to understand the power of design. It's not only based on areas and efficiencies and the bottom line. I think when there's less properties out there, I think it becomes a little bit more competitive. And by being more competitive, I think design, focused design, that maybe brings a little bit more of added value, which is a good thing for us.
One of the key trends to come out of this is the popularity of mixed-use buildings and developments.
So the value added is offering a better lifestyle, a better opportunity, a better way to enjoy the environment. So a lot of my projects tend to have a lot more focus on the civic qualities that the projects offer, even back to the community. And a few years ago, a developer would not be interested in paying a premium for this. But now they understand that that's what the city wants. And by offering this, then the city might give them that right piece of land and you'll get the right clientele. So it's all kind of wrapped together, but it's a good thing. It's basically putting the people first and not the money.
So where does all this leave the role of the architect? Well, for Stephen Hodder, although this role has changed, it's still a vital cog in the machine.
I think that as architects, we have a unique ability to imagine the city and to use that imagination and passion to create great places. And so the architect, I've always seen as being pivotal in all of that. But increasingly, we have to recognize that we're only one part of this sort of big machine that delivers quality in our cities.
That was Matt Allagai's report from the MIPIM Property Fair in Cannes. You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Now, style at sea, that's the subject of a new book by fashion historian Amber Jane Butchett. In Nautical Chic, the author looks at how nautical fashion never goes out of style, proving to be perennial influences for modern designers such as Jean-Paul Gaultier in his Sexy Sailors, to the famous Breton tops eternalized by Brigitte Bardot. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to Amber Jane at Midori House.
I grew up by the sea. I grew up in a fisherman's cottage. So kind of had an interest from childhood. And then about 10 years ago, I did my MA at London College of Fashion. And I actually focused on it for my dissertation. I looked at the influence of sailor uniform on Victorian women's swimwear. So it was something I've had a long-standing interest in, always been interested in the fact that it's such a perennial style, like it's on every spring catwalk, basically. And I was just really amazed that no one had really looked into this before and had tried to sort of track these items and track these trends.
At what point those clothes became part of the fashion world?
Different items crossed over at different points in history. So throughout the book, I cover five different professions in five different chapters. I've got the officer, the sailor, the fisherman, the sportsman, and the pirate. And each of those, the sort of starting point is a different time in history. So like just for example, the officer kind of starts in the mid-18th century with the birth of naval uniform. The sailor kind of starts a century later when sailors, sort of ordinary seamen's uniform was standardised. And then again, so you get a different point in history as well at the point where those kind of items crossed over into women's wear or into sort of fashionable civilian clothing. So there's lots of different kind of historical starting points throughout the book.
The book is divided in five chapters. The officer, it's interesting because I know the recent Gucci spring summer collection is all influenced about nautical style as well. So can you tell us a little bit more about the officer? Is it more kind of tailored and strict perhaps?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The officer look really focuses on tailoring and it focuses on embellishment as well. Things like braiding, gold, buttons, these kind of elements. It's really about trying to create a sort of spectacle of power. That's what that kind of uniform is really about. And when it was initially introduced, sort of in the mid-18th century, it wasn't really about creating functional dress. It was about creating something that would really show the status of the men wearing it. At that time, officers were gentlemen. You had to be born into a specific class to be able to become an officer. Uniform was really about showing that sort of power and prestige through the clothing.
And then you have, of course, the sailor, which is something sexier, may I say. You know, there's more of va-va-voom, a little bit Jean-Paul Gaultier there as well.
Classique, le mal, fragrances by Jean-Paul Gaultier.
That kind of element of the sailor being a gay icon was a really sort of fun area to research. It's something, as you say, that comes up again throughout Gaultier's designs. But there's quite a long lineage of the sailor being kind of sexualized. Even if you look back into sort of late Victorian print media, like illustrated newspapers, that kind of thing, there's a certain virility, physicality to the way that sailors were depicted. There's a lot more sort of robust masculinity going on than there was with the officers, which were often depicted as being kind of almost feminized in a way. So there's this kind of, very interesting long lineage of the sailor being quite sexualized and being this very physical, manly icon that then has been reappropriated by designers like Gaultier.
And perhaps one of the most famous ones was the fisherman, because then, you know, it was the style that Brigitte Bardot used to use, the Breton tops, correct? So can you tell us a little bit more about that as well?
Yeah, well, the fisherman comes from workwear. So not from, it's different to uniform, to the two first chapters, because it comes from clothing that was very much designed to be practical and to help you do your day-to-day job. And for fishermen, the day-to-day job is very treacherous, you know, life-threatening. So you get a lot of different items coming from there. I look a bit at waterproof clothing in the book, sort of the yellow Macintosh, things like that, sou'wester hat. And then, of course, the striped top that developed from French fishermen's wear and then was eventually adopted into the French Navy as well as part of naval uniform. And what's interesting, I think, about that chapter is that you get quite a lot of interest, like artist communities quite often have a big interest in fishing villages. You get a lot throughout the early 20th century, a lot of sort of artist retreats spring up in fishing villages. There's this very romantic idea of what fishing is like as an occupation that's completely removed from the reality of it. And I think that's where you get the first instances of the striped top being worn as a fashion item rather than just as workwear.
And finally, we also have the sportsman. And which is more kind of about luxury wear on your yacht, perhaps, or something like that.
The sportsman chapter really looks at that kind of preppy Americana look that we associate with the East Coast and with yachting style. So it kind of starts off in the Gilded Age of sort of late Victorian, early Edwardian yachting competitions around the East Coast and moves on to sort of Ivy League campuses and brands that have really made that look their own, ranging from Ralph Lauren and Tommy Hilfiger through to more recent brands like J.Crew.
That's End of the Pirates, which is completely different as well from the other chapters. And I believe Vivienne Westwood was one of the designers who did use quite a lot of this influence.
Well, Malcolm McLaren and Vivienne Westwood's first catwalk show, the World's End Collection in 1981, is called the Pirate Collection because it drew very much on these kind of historical styles, but also was very much to do with actual music piracy as well. That was McLaren's main influence, the interest of the place that the music industry was in at the time. So it's interesting that you've got those two different ideas of piracy, the two different sort of meanings of piracy going on there. And yeah, the pirate chapter is interesting as well because a lot of it is to do with the sort of cultural history of the pirates, which is a very mythologized figure. You know, we know about pirates from things like Peter Pan. You have to look a bit further before you actually get into the sort of real history of pirates. They become this very romantic, mythologized figure, and that's the element that tends to come through in fashion.
I have a difficult question for you. What's your favorite piece of nautical clothing? Perhaps you own one.
Oh, that is very difficult. I kind of fell in love with each of them all over again as I was writing the book. I'll always have a very soft spot for the sailor collar as a sort of detail. I think it gives a sort of cheeky element to any outfit. It's kind of reminiscent of, it has that kind of Gautier kitsch. It also has that sort of, is reminiscent of seaside holidays. I think it's just a really fun item.
Bon voyage!
That was Amber-Jane Butchett speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco. This is Monocle 24 Section D with me, Tom Morris, where we will be back straight after this.
The people of Trabzon in Turkey are tough, patriotic and proud of their culture. Monocle traveled to the region to look at its potential for tourism and to find out what's holding it back.
Trabzon province between the Black Sea and the Kaçkar Mountains is Turkey's highlands, home to hilltop mosques and walnut groves that cling to its craggy cliffs. In this precipitous wilderness, it's not uncommon to carry a pistol. It's easy to see why its residents are considered the tough guys of Turkey.
Hidden Depths, a photographic essay, now playing in the film section of Monocle.com.
You're listening to Section D. Now, Thomas Heatherwick, famed designer of the revamped London buses and the London 2012 Olympic cauldron, has opened an insightful exhibition titled Inside Heatherwick Studio at the Singapore National Design Centre. The exhibition launched as part of Singapore Design Week and was backed by the British Council. Monocle's Jeremy Toh speaks to the man himself about one of his latest projects, Singapore's Nanyang Technological University Learning Hub.
My studio was set up 20 years ago and we're a collection of people working together on mainly public projects. So whether that's a new university building or a new bus for London or a even a power station. Our passion is things that you encounter in more public life rather than people's private apartments or works in art galleries.
I've noticed something about the studio. The studio never works on the same thing again twice in terms of the kind of project it is. Could you explain why this conscientious decision?
In our working method, we've tried to develop an expertise. I don't feel we're multidisciplinary. I feel we work with one discipline, and that's design in three dimensions. And problems happen when people are regarded as being experts because certain kinds of outcome get repeated when they maybe sometimes need a fresh pair of eyes. So we've tried to evolve a way of being experts at not being experts in the way we work, but we surround ourselves with experts. In a way, nothing more so as a project example than our project here in Singapore at Nanyang Technical University, where we were commissioned by the professors and the board of the university to build a new university building. And in the past, you used to go to university because that's where the books were, or in the past, you used to go to university because that's where all the computers were. And now you can stay in bed and get a PhD. What's the purpose of these gigantic university buildings anymore? And so the role of the Learning Hub was to be a complement to the existing facilities, which were designed before this digital revolution happened that changed pedagogy of the educational environment that we're all in now. And the very long corridors were no longer feeling appropriate. And in fact, we decided to make a building with no long corridors, because the purpose of university now was surely to bump into people, to meet your future business partner, to meet the person you'd have a great idea with, or someone you'll come up with new political ideas with, or set up a charity with. And these long corridors, it's only if there's a fire alarm that you get to meet other people in the building. And so there was a very different kind of a brief in what we were doing, and so it generated a different outcome, unsurprisingly, but led by the professors and their demands for what they describe as flipped learning. And they ordered us to have no corners on the tutorial rooms. And so we obeyed and looked at how we could work with the social functioning and try to make something that is very much working around the human scale, which doesn't emphasize monotony and repetition and endless long facades. And so rather than building one big fat new university building, it's 12 slim towers that are stitched together very loosely, really, with some connected walkways. And it means that the building is porous. And we spent time in some of the hawker centers with their big-ass fans, which I'd never heard of. The big-ass fan is the technical name for those big fans, and these naturally ventilated environments, and wondered whether we could make a building which didn't have a giant air-conditioned central space, and could we achieve something that has rarely ever been achieved before, but the highest possible environmental certification for an educational building, Green Mark Platinum here in Singapore. And there were particular code quirks here in Singapore, the buildability scoring and things that were funny things to work with. But that, combined with a very modest budget, it wasn't a huge amount more than for a car park, meant that the project became about using concrete. With that budget, we knew that there was no money to make the kind of perfection of concrete that has been worshipped by many architects in recent decades. And instead, we worked with an artist who did 700 drawings, these paintings with ink, which were thought triggers. And working with her, Sara Finelli, we embedded those. In the exhibition here, we have the molds that were used. It was just some of the molds, so that you wouldn't see the repetition. But it means that the cores, which normally are always having cladding panels stuck in front of them, that we knew would fall off in 5 years, and then there'll be sad holes where cladding's fallen off. Our philosophy driving us with the project was to have nothing stuck on and it all be inherent. And that's really carried through. And so the project really feels like ceramic. The thing that I'm most excited about is that the building feels handmade. And that's very rare for modern buildings to feel handmade. They tend to look like machines have made them. And there's an accompanying sterility that goes with that. And often you feel that a building has to be 100 years old before it will get any soulfulness. And our building's got bubbles in the concrete and stones poking through, but it's got a heart that you can feel, and it really feels like it's made by hands. And it has this very innovative cooling in the rooms, which has no fans, that allowed it to be so low energy. So the walls have a slot that allows the cool air to drop down without any fans down the back of the wall and come under you, and the natural convection of the heat of people makes it work.
The exhibition is really looking into the design process of your studio when you take on a project. I realize there's a bit of a vulnerability when you open up your thought processes to somebody from the outside. Why did you decide to do that?
Maybe I'm a fool and shouldn't have done. But we had a very, very gifted curator, and she made a very persuasive argument to show things that we've never shown before. And I suppose when I was little, I was very influenced as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-old by certain things that I saw. And I could see that if we showed what she suggested, if I can get over my vanity at these things done when I was so young, that they might help to be a bridge to young people who might be thinking of coming in this direction of this kind of world, to help them connect and not feel that this is some unattainable world of making things that isn't actually just the outcome of lots of interests, but lots of working very hard over a period of time.
That was Monocle's Jeremy Toe speaking to British designer Thomas Heatherwick at his exhibition Inside Heatherwick's Studio at the Singapore National Design Centre, which is open until the 12th of April. This is Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. And now we head to Spain, where an economic malaise has forced local architects abroad in search of greener pastures. For years, the country has been lamenting the loss of local talent, but a new exhibition in Madrid's Eco Museum aims to illustrate how the country's legion of globetrotting architects has been triumphing. Export is the culmination of extensive research from the architect, curator and teacher Edgar Gonzalez, who enlisted design studio 2x4 to beautifully conceptualise his findings. My very own Liam Aldous met with Gonzalez at the museum to discuss the less talked about dividends of Spain's roving talent and why Spanish architects are increasingly cementing their foothold around the world.
It's very interesting because you can see like the before the crisis and after the crisis scenarios. And the before crisis was amazing, no? Because the Spanish architecture abroad is too low in that space of time because there was so much work in Spain, you know? I had students, when I was a teacher, I had students that they were already building buildings before finishing their degree, you know? Because there was so much work that nobody even talked about, you know, going abroad.
In Spain, the bursting of the construction bubble and subsequent financial crisis prompted a mass exodus of Spanish architects, who spread out across the world to China, the Middle East, Latin America, and beyond.
The exhibition is laid out basically in two main spaces. One of the spaces talks about this time frame I selected, you know, because I picked two icons of Spanish architecture abroad. One is from 2002 to 2014. In 2002 is the Yokohama Port Terminal in Tokyo, made by Alejandro Saera and his partner in that time, Farshid Mousavi. It was a huge competition. It was a very, very important competition. It was won when Alejandro was like 32 years. So it was really, really a groundbreaking scenario because at that time, you know, it was in 1995. In 1995, they won this competition and they have to move there because they were so young. And the second building I selected is the Rijksmuseum, which is opened in Amsterdam by Cruz y Ortiz, you know, very, very prominent Spanish architects from the south. They're based in Sevilla. And this because being this big icon that encloses. So from 2000 to 2014, we could see this scenario because we have 2008 right in the middle, no? With the fall of Lehman Brothers right in the middle. So this time frame will allow me to set a pre-crisis scenario and a post-crisis scenario in the research. I selected 200 buildings that have been built in this period of time. Some of the buildings are not finished yet, but they are in construction. No? This is what we can see here. No? It's a big mosaic of 200 buildings. They don't have any order in particular because I don't want to highlight or establish a hierarchy here.
So there's so many projects coloring the walls here. What do you think sets Spanish architecture apart from other national brands of architecture? Mm-hmm.
I think Spanish architecture has to do a lot with education. The Spanish architect has this mix of technical and artistic. In other countries, for instance, in England or in Italy, you know, the architect is more kind of an artist. No, they don't actually take on technical issues, calculus. And in other ones, for example, Germany, the architect is a bit more technical. No, it's more technical oriented. But in Spain, the curricula is really, really strong in both areas. I think that makes the Spanish professional to stand out, you know, because this mixture of these two, because it's almost an engineer, an architect in Spain is almost an engineer, but as well, it's an artist.
We move upstairs to the main part of the exhibition, filled with a dynamic visual display that outlines Edgar's research into every imaginable facet of Spanish architecture and its imprint on the world. These days, the prevailing sentiment in Spain is that the architectural brain drain has been an incredible loss for the country. Armed with his research, Edgar begs to differ.
I think one of the main benefits of Spanish architects going abroad is all the knowledge, you know, they can bring back. So, I mean, if you go out abroad, you practice a couple of years in some other country, when you come back, this vision of globalization in the good sense, you can practice your architecture in a different way, no?
The sheer density of information and visual references highlight the extent of Edgar's research, but graphs and tables also help visitors digest key data. A graph shows how the end of Spain's property boom and cuts to government spending in 2008 sparked a sharp dip in national projects. At the same time, international projects by Spanish studios leapt tenfold, illustrating the modern Spanish architect's new outward vision spurred on by necessity. However, Edgar also reserves a special place for the unsung heroes of Spanish architecture.
I start the exhibition with insiders because I like to showcase these are the more anonymous way of practicing architecture. No? These are, young and not young architects that move abroad to work for somebody else, no? To work for big offices. And to depict this, what I did a research and I found a lot of people working abroad. And what I asked them is like to have the minute of fame. I asked them to take themselves a selfie in the office they work. No? They have big offices like Zaha Hadid, Norman Foster, MBRDV. All the big offices are showcased here. And they took a picture and a small interview. And they have this panel with a collage of all the pictures that we took them from them. The main idea of having this exhibition is not to tell people what to think, but to provide a lot of highlights so they can make connections and draw up their own conclusions.
Is there an intention to evoke a more positive sentiment, talking or thinking about Spanish talent and Spanish architecture?
I think Spanish architecture is in a good shape right now. And I think these wanted to highlight this good shape of the Spanish architecture, as well as this more broader sense of what practicing architecture today is.
That was Monocle's Madrid correspondent Liam Aldis reporting on the Export exhibition running at the city's Eco Museum now. And that is all we have time for on this edition of Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you have any comments or questions. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.